I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation, to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. Shalom, and welcome to the Everlasting Nation Broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions in Hickson, Tennessee. Now here's your host, IBJM Ministries Director, John Lawrence.
Greetings to our listeners, and thank you so much for tuning in today. I am John Lawrence, your host. I've been sharing with you about our amazing trip to Mexico recently, where we met so many young people who are very interested in Jewish missions. In addition to the candidate school for potential missionaries that we conducted down there, there was also a four-day focus on Jewish missions the following week that was also held, and many more people attended those sessions to learn how to be more effective in their witness with Jewish people, many of them desiring to reach out to Jewish people through their own local churches in places like Mexico City and Monterrey, both of which have significant Jewish populations. The church there in San Luis Potosí, where we were, also has a Bible Institute with over 300 students. Many of the students came to our sessions also, and some wanted to be interviewed already as potential missionaries to the Jews. The missionary conference that week, during which our sessions were just one part of the program, attracted hundreds of people from all over Mexico and even beyond, a number of them from Latin America, from South America. There were sessions going on for pastors, others for missionaries. There were special sessions for women, for youth pastors, and of course, then there was our program for Jewish missions. The excitement and commitment to the work of spreading the gospel is really contagious down there. Everybody is excited about getting out and sharing the gospel with others. I wish I could introduce you to many of these young people that I met. I wish you could have the experience also of being in one of these large Mexican churches. We attended services at the church there on Sunday. The place was packed for the morning service, upwards of 1,000 people. The service of praise and worship and preaching lasts about 2 hours, but then at noontime that service lets out and they pack the place again for another 2-hour service that runs until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But then there's also an evening service that starts at 6 p.m., and it was very startling even that the evening service had no fewer people than were present in the morning service. So they come back. They come back for evening service. They come back for prayer meeting on Wednesdays. They're all very committed Christians. There's a thirst for the Word of God and a real keen desire to put it into practice. Buses bring not only children to the services, but many adults as well in that city of over 1 million people, where there aren't too many means of public transportation, and many people also do not have cars. I was particularly struck by very elderly people in the church, some of them even quite crippled, who nonetheless managed to come out for all the services. They were helped off the buses and into their seats by church workers, or struggling in on the arms of family members. It was quite moving to see these people who probably, ordinarily, one wouldn't expect to come to church, yet they wanted to be there. There was a real joy in the Lord among these folks, expressed also in a great joy to be in church, to hear the Word of God, to worship with other believers. It was an extraordinary experience, really, that I am not entirely sure that I have the words to fully describe. It was a personal blessing to me, and the young people there are clearly a very real part of the future of missions in general, but also of our mission in particular, important to reaching unreached Jewish mission fields that are waiting to hear of Jesus the Messiah. Pray for them, would you? And pray for revival here in our own country, that God will be pleased to reignite the flame here in our hearts for the gospel. Now let's join Jewish believer Brother Mark Oshman for today's Bible study.
Welcome back to our radio broadcast. We will resume our study of biblical roles and offices by looking how kings functioned in the governmental system of Israel. Israel's neighbor nations had kings to rule over them. Nimrod, mentioned in Genesis chapter 10, ruled over territory located in the vicinity of Assyria and Babylon. Genesis chapter 14 indicated that the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah both had sovereigns, as did other cities. Kings governed the Edomites, descendants of Jacob's brother Esau. Kings governed the Edomites before Israel had kings. During their journeys, the early Jews interacted with a number of foreign sovereigns. Abraham and Isaac had dealings with kings in Gerar. Jacob and Moses appeared before pharaohs in Egypt. According to Numbers chapter 20, Moses asked King of Edom for permission so that the Israelites could walk across his territory, permission that was refused. The narrative in Numbers chapter 21 records the Jewish victories over Arad, the king of the Canaanites, and Sihon, the king of the Amorites. The Israelites fought against a number of Canaanite kings after they crossed the Jordan River. On one occasion, recorded in the 10th chapter of Joshua, they defeated a confederacy composed of five such Canaanite monarchs. The Israelites defeated a total of 31 Canaanite kings, according to Joshua chapter 12. God authored the Jewish people themselves to anoint kings. In the 17th chapter of Deuteronomy, he declared, quote, "When thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shalt possess it, and shalt dwell therein, and shalt say, I will set a king over me like as all the other nations that are about me." Unquote. The language God used in the latter portion of that text suggested that he made this arrangement possible as an accommodation to the hardness of Jewish hearts. Nonetheless, he set requirements for Jewish kings. The Jewish people had to choose a king from among their fellow Jews. This provision apparently included individuals who had converted to Judaism. Herod the Great, for example, who Augustus Caesar had designated as king of the Jews. Herod the Great came from an Edomite family which had embraced Judaism. According to one historical anecdote, Herod wept when he publicly read the passage contained in Deuteronomy chapter 17. Herod the Great publicly wept, according to the story, saying that he did not qualify to be king of the Jews, since his family was not Jewish. The Mosaic law forbade kings from doing certain things. These monarchs could not multiply financial assets, increase the number of horses they owned, or the number of women they married. Several Jewish kings violated these prohibitions. Solomon was notorious for the latter. According to 1 Kings chapter 10, he had 1,400 chariots and 1,200 horsemen. Solomon had riches that exceeded those of all other earthly monarchs. He also had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Numbers recorded in 1 Kings chapter 11. God commanded all Jewish kings to maintain personal copies of the law of Moses and to continually read from that book. This practice seemingly fell into disuse. Indeed, when priests during King Josiah's reign found a copy of the law in the temple, and they read its contents to the king, Josiah grieved over the extent to which he and his contemporaries had deviated from God's commands. For several hundred years, Israel had functioned without a king. When Samuel served as a judge, according to 1 Samuel chapter 8, the Jewish people did not want his sons to follow him. They said, quote, "Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations," unquote. Though the request saddened Samuel, he brought the matter to God in prayer. God replied, quote, "Hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them," unquote. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, moreover, God commanded Samuel to tell the Israelites what having a monarch would cost them. A king would appropriate their sons to become his servants. Furthermore, a king would confiscate their fields and turn them over to his servants. Finally, a king would take one-tenth of their livestock for his own uses. Even after hearing this, the Israelites still wanted the king to reign over them, quote, "that we may also may be like the other nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles," unquote. Saul, from the tribe of Benjamin, became the first king of Israel. He had encountered Samuel while looking for donkeys that his father had lost, an incident recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 10. The elderly judge afterward anointed the young man with oil, telling him, quote, "Is it not that the Lord hath anointed thee to be captain over his inheritance?" Unquote. Samuel cast lots in the presence of the Jewish people to determine who would reign in Israel. He had previously warned the Israelites, quote, "Ye have this day rejected your God, who himself saved you out of all your adversities and tribulations. And ye have said unto him, Nay, but set a king over us." Unquote. Even though God sent the Jewish nation a king, just as he promised to do in Deuteronomy 17, their attitude in this matter evoked his displeasure. Therefore, God gave the Jewish people a monarch as an accommodation to the hardness of their hearts. As the first king of Israel, chosen by the lot that Samuel cast, Saul began well. He led the Israelites to victory against Nahash, the king of the Ammonites. Saul also defeated the Philistines in a key battle, as recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 14. Before long, though, Saul started showing disturbing tendencies. His impatience led him to make a burnt offering himself. Furthermore, Saul would have executed his own son, Jonathan, for unknowingly violating the prohibition that he had himself instituted, but Jonathan was unaware of. Finally, Saul kept the king of Amalek alive, despite God's direct orders to destroy the Amalekites utterly. Saul had repeatedly contravened God's commands. Thus, God rejected Saul as king. In 1 Samuel chapter 15, Samuel told Saul, quote, "The Lord hath rent the kingdom of Israel from thee this day, and hath given it to a neighbor of thine that is better than thou," unquote. Shortly thereafter, God directed Samuel to anoint David to be the next king of Israel after Saul. Unlike Saul, David did not stand head and shoulders physically above his contemporaries. Yet, the author of 1 Samuel chapter 13 alluded to David as, quote, "a man after his, God's, own heart." God enabled David to perform mighty exploits, amongst them killing the giant Goliath. David did commit grievous sins, though, such as committing adultery with Bathsheba and taking a census of the Israelites that God had not commanded him to do. For the most part, though, David followed God. Their adherence set a standard for those monarchs who followed David on the throne. According to 2 Chronicles chapter 17, for example, God commended King Jehoshaphat of Judah because, quote, "he walked in the first ways of his father David," unquote. During the reign of David's grandson, Rehoboam, God subdivided the Jewish nation into two kingdoms, the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. All of the following sovereigns in Judah, except for Queen Athaliah, all of the sovereigns in Judah who followed Rehoboam descended directly from David. In the northern kingdom of Israel, though, every one of the kings practiced evil. Yet, God still allowed them to take the throne of Israel and rule. As God declared in the 13th chapter of Hosea, quote, "I gave thee a king in mine anger, and took him away in my wrath," unquote. Jeroboam, the first king of the northern kingdom of Israel, Jeroboam established golden calves for the Israelites in that kingdom to worship. He put these idols in the cities of Bethel and Dan. Here was his legacy as mentioned throughout 1 Kings and 2 Kings. The sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. Sometimes Jewish kings influence their subjects in a positive way. King Hezekiah of Judah, going to 2 Chronicles 29, led the priests and the people in a project that involved cleansing the temple. More frequently, though, Jewish kings influenced their subject for evil. The author of 2 Chronicles chapter 33 wrote that King Manasseh, quote, "made Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to err and to do worse than the heathen," unquote. In some places, monarchs that continued to reign throughout the New Testament era. Other political institutions existed around the same time as well. We invite you to turn into our next radio Bible study to learn more about these biblical roles and offices.
You've been listening to the Everlasting Nation broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. For more information, you can write us at P.O. Box 1386, Hickson, Tennessee 37343, or call us at 423-876-8150, or you may also go online at ibjm.org. Until next time, may God bless and shalom.